Alright, we're in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. We're finishing up lesson 6 and getting into lesson 7. And ideally, I keep saying this every time, one of these times I'm gonna learn. Ideally, we will catch up and we'll finish up lesson 7 tonight. However, this is one of the lessons that I planned on possibly using the extra lesson. We have 12 lessons to cover in 13 periods. So, this is one of the ones that I would be happy to burn the extra class on. So, we may not finish tonight. Alright, so this is a review. We have our outline from 2 Thessalonians, and just our bookends, the greeting, the closing, the extension of grace, and then the salutation and the benediction in the end. And in between, we have three sections, which pretty well break down with the chapters. Chapter 1, the main point seems to be perseverance, the hold on. Paul is very much aware of the persecution, and he's telling them that God's going to take care of it. There's going to be a reckoning. And the next thing related very closely to that is trying to quiet their fears, to console them. They apparently were concerned that the Lord's return was going to be very soon. Maybe, some people have speculated, maybe going back to chapter 4, verse 15 in 1 Thessalonians, where he says, we that are alive will join them. You know, he includes himself. And so maybe they got the idea, oh, we're all going to still, some of us going to be alive, some of us. So maybe that was part of it. Or maybe there was something else going on that we're going to talk about tonight. But he wants to console that fear and quiet that down and let them know that they've not missed the Lord's return. And then this last part of chapter 2, and then chapter 3 gets into the idea of adhering to the apostolic tradition and make sure that they stand fast in the traditions that are given to them. Alright, we read through this last time, last few verses here in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. The main point here in this chapter is consoling them, letting them know that God's going to be righteous, he's going to repay, he's going to set this persecution right, there will be a punishing, but there will also be a reward, and Paul's prayer for them is that God would count them worthy of this, and that he would fulfill all of his good pleasure in them. So, and you'll see this is a pattern that's kind of carried over in chapter 2, that don't be concerned, God's going to make this right, there's going to be a reckoning, but you're not going to be included in that punishment. So, you kind of see that three-way pattern as we go through it. Alright, we had our questions from last time. So based on this passage, why are the saints separated from those who will be destroyed? How are they different? What does he say? Why are certain ones picked out for destruction?
They didn't obey the gospel.
What else? There's three things, kind of, not all together, but three things are mentioned in the passage. They didn't know God, one of them.
To persecute the saints.
I believe he mentions the fact that they didn't know God, they didn't obey, and then he says that this is kind of the other side of the coin, so that's part of what's throwing it off and making it a real mind question. He says, in that day to be glorified in his saints and to be admired among all those who believe, because our testimony among you was believed. So they believed, they obeyed the gospel, they knew God. These are three things that make a distinction. So the point is that God's not going to save everyone. There is a difference, there is a distinction, and it's a visible set of actions that these people choose and something that they do. Alright, so what's going to be different in that day? Paul says that in that day he'll be admired by his saints. Can we not admire him now? What's the difference? That's kind of an easy one.
Sight and faith.
Right. We will see his face. So there's one thing to see him by faith now, but to see him by sight in the glory of heaven, that will be yet another thing. So a great and profound thought there. All right. This is one thing. We've kind of talked about this a little in an earlier class, but I think it's important to pick out because I've actually known of people who grew up in a Christian background, and they eventually apostatized, and this was the reason. Atheists accuse our God of being a sort of egomaniac. Does verse 10 indicate that the Lord seeks our admiration and glory? says that he comes to be admired by all of his saints.
He will be, but there are other verses that say that he didn't need any of this.
Right, right, exactly. I think one of the ones we mentioned before, and no, he doesn't need us. Go back to Psalms 50 about the cattle on a thousand hills are his. If he was hungry, he wouldn't let us know. If he was thirsty, he wouldn't ask us. He can take care of himself. So it's not not something that he does because we or because he needs it. It's actually out of love because we need it. And if you look at or think about Revelation, think about that throne scene, the faithful want to be as close as they can to Jesus. That's their reward. That's the thing that they're looking forward to. Alright, what would be the fulfillment? Just explain this last verse here in chapter 1. What would be the fulfillment of all of God's good pleasure, of his goodness, and the work of faith and power? What is he talking about there? Salvation begins now, right? We're saved now. You think about Acts 2, 37, 38, verse 47, those that are saved are added to the church. And we go back to chapter 1 in 1 Thessalonians 1. Their character, their faith, their hope, and their love, their character was already evident that they were elect. But yet, salvation is not ultimately realized until Judgment Day. Something can happen between now and then. And I think that's part of Paul's point when he says that may God count you worthy. It's still up for debate. It's not sealed. It's not cut in stone yet. So he had great confidence in them, but there was still work to be done. All right, Chris, what were you going to say?
That along the lines of those that will be faithful and make it to the end.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right, so just other passages to think about is verses talk about God's goodness leading us to repentance and those who don't accept that goodness ultimately being condemned, but those who seek eternal life and honor and glory, that will be their reward. All right, so he also talks about our name being glorified in Christ. How can that ever happen? By what means will that be achieved? What do you think?
Our obedience and our faithfulness is a reflection of his glory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's some glory that's attributed there when we reflect that. Good thought.
As it says in other places, we look in the mirror and try to become mm-hmm. what he was.
Mm-hmm.
We can't reach perfection, but we can always attain perfection.
Right, we're being transformed. I think 2 Corinthians 3 at the end of it talks about us being transformed from glory to glory. And so there's this constant growth and the glorification that's associated with that. That's a very good point. Proverbs talks about, I remember the verse now, it talks about the path of the righteous and the glory of it just getting brighter and brighter, just like the sun. It's something that as we journey down that path, it becomes more and more evident that the nature of the path, that it's the correct path to choose and the glory of it. Another thought that came to mind is, you think about Romans 14, every knee is going to bow before Jesus. Every knee or every mouth is going to confess Jesus. And yet we're told in Matthew 10, 32, 33, that if we're faithful, then he will confess us before the Father as well. So there's also glory in that last day to come directly from Jesus if we're faithful and willing to confess him no matter what now. All right, any other thoughts or questions on this?
I don't know if this would be the same thing, but I think we talked a little bit about the scene where Satan comes before God and they're discussing Job.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this would be pure speculation, but if God glories in those that are faithful throughout time,
mm-hmm.
I mean, does Satan go on a regular basis and contend for those?
It could very well be. I mean, we don't know. It's a difficult question, and in my understanding, based on Revelations 12, is that after the cross, the accuser is no longer given that platform to make that accusation. So that may have been, again, I say may have been something that changed after the cross. But, you know, if it didn't change then I don't know why it wouldn't have otherwise. Also, on the other hand, some. Okay. All right, very good thoughts. We talked about this before, so I won't dwell on this. Just noticing the point that he says that he's praying that God would count you worthy of his calling. And I think there's an important distinction to bring out is that we're not necessarily worthy of heaven, per se, is that we've earned it, but worthy of the invitation itself, of the calling, that we are worth God's invitation, the extension of that, the fact that we actually partake of it and follow through with it. Alright, so key lessons. Again, just remember how Paul started off. Very thankful for the Thessalonians. Again, noticing just like in the first letter, their faith, their love, and I think that should have been like enduring patience or something else instead of repeating faith again. But also the perseverance, that's something they needed to continue, that God was willing to be righteous, and his mercies will be exonerated by their demonstrating worthiness and enduring persecution. And then his justice will be exonerated by him punishing the disobedient and finally rewarding believers. And then also just the idea that this punishment is going to happen in and of itself should strike fear in people's hearts if they believe what they're reading. And so this should be a motivation to those who may be wavering or, you know, moments of weakness. And then we talked also about everlasting destruction, about eternity in hell being separated from God. And then the reward for the believer is actually be close to God. All right, any other thoughts before we leave this chapter and get into chapter 2? All right. So, chapter 2. Now let's read this. First 8 verses here. All right. Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him, we ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled, either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us, as though the day of Christ had come. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed. The son of perdition who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Do you not remember that when I was still with you, I told you these things? And now you know what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. Okay, so again, this is a kind of a similar pattern. It begins by consoling them. Obviously, they're concerned that they've missed the day of the Lord, and he's telling them, no, you haven't missed it. Something has to happen first. All right, so just as for context, the Bible refers to many different days of the Lord. In fact, the destruction of Jerusalem is described as the coming of Jesus. Luke 21, 20-38 is one example. So which day of the Lord is discussed here in chapter 2? How do we know?
They were sorry they missed it. They wouldn't be sorry about missing destruction of Jerusalem, I don't think so.
Yeah, that's a good thought. I think it's very true. That's incompatible, I think, with the context.
Verse 1 says that they were going to be gathered together with him. So whatever that day is, it's going to, you know, that would imply the day of judgment.
So it seems like if we back up to chapter 1 just a little bit, just as you guys have brought out already, if we just stick with the context, again, what day are we talking about? The day when the Lord is returned with mighty angels and flaming fire, and there's going to be everlasting destruction and punishment, being driven from the Lord when he comes in that day to be glorified in his saints. And then we go a few more verses in chapter 1, now concerning the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him. So, as you brought out, that sounds like the resurrection. This is when everybody's being brought to him finally. So, if we stick with the context, if we look at what we have here in verse 1, the association with the resurrection, and then as Alan said, why would they be concerned about missing the destruction of Jerusalem? It just doesn't fit. So all those things tell us which day of the Lord that we're talking about. All right, very good. So what possible sources of misleading influences Paul anticipated to cut off? Seems like they may have got some bad information. Maybe they misunderstood 1 Thessalonians 4:15, but there's kind of a clue they may have got some bad information for me.
Either a fake letter or false teachers or something.
It seems like something's kind of fishy going there, especially if you think about Paul being in Corinth, and then later when we get to 1 and especially 2 Corinthians, dealing with false teachers, fake apostles, that's one of the prominent themes. In fact, 2 Corinthians, is the whole point of that book is to prove his apostleship. He's being challenged as an apostle now. And so that seems very likely. But I think we get a clue here in this verse 1 and 2. He says, not to be soon shaken in mind or trouble, either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us. As if you received it from us. But it hadn't come from them. So don't treat it as it had come from them. So I think the insinuation is whatever they're getting, don't give it the same authority. Don't give it the same opinion or regard as you would as if it was from us. So whether it's by word or by letter, spoken voice or the epistle. And then I think this kind of goes along with this idea as well. The salutation of Paul, with my own hand, which is a sign in every epistle, so I write. So he's got kind of his own personal stamp of approval. They should be able to recognize his signature in the letter. And he's making a point of that notice my signature in this letter. So, you know, again, why do that unless there's some concern that somebody's trying to fake that? And then just reminiscent of Galatians 1:8, if we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel to you than what we have preached to you, let him be accursed. So, even if it's a spirit, even if it's an angel that comes and tries to tell them something different, know that it's not genuine. It's not from us. It's not authorized. Okay, so they're not to be deceived or easily shaken. Any other thoughts? Alright. So, now kind of getting more into the meat of the chapter, what events will precede that great day when the Lord returns? What did he tell them not to worry? What had to happen first? Alright, so we have that they will not come unless first the falling away comes first. And the man of sin is revealed. And as some people have pointed out, it seems that there's an order here. It's not just that they're coming together, but this falling away has to happen first. There has to be this apostasy. And that seems to set the scene. That seems to enable this man of sin to come forth and be revealed, the son of perdition. All right, so these are the two things that have to happen first. And obviously, by the time of this writing, they had not happened yet. All right, now, just kind of a general question. Can Bible mysteries be understood? We're thinking about the mystery of lawlessness. A lot of people say, it's a mystery. You can't understand it. Can they be understood? Are they just? Does that mean they're just impossible to comprehend?
Well, some things that were mysteries can be understood because they were later revealed. So the general answer is, well, yes, some can.
Right.
Not all, but there's some that God doesn't hinder us to understand at this point. The main mysteries and things you'll choose to reveal.
So the key is revelation. And there's a difference in words between the way the Bible's using mystery and revelation and the way we sometimes use mystery. When we talk about something being a mystery, it's just too tough. It's too complicated. I just can't get my head wrapped around it. You know, it's calculus. It's a mystery to me. I just don't get it. But that's not what mystery means in the Bible. All right, so how do we know that? Just an example, Ephesians 3, Paul talks about how that by revelation, he made known to me the mystery. All right, exact same Greek word here. It's mysterion. As I have briefly written already, by which when you read, you may understand my knowledge in the mystery of Christ. So it wasn't that it was impossible to comprehend. It just had to be revealed first. It was hidden. And that's actually what this word mysterion means. It means it's hidden. It's covered up. And when it's revealed, it's uncovered, then you can see it. It's not the complexity. It's just the fact that it's hidden. It's put away. And once someone reveals it, someone explains it, shows it, then it can be understood. So when we read what Paul wrote, we can understand his knowledge of the mystery of Christ. All right, several other verses that you can also look at that have very similar idea about mystery being something that was previously not known, but now it's spoken, now it's revealed, now it's brought to light, now people can understand it. All right, so what is this mystery of lawlessness? What do you think? Now notice what I didn't ask. I didn't ask who is the man of sin. I said, what is the mystery of lawlessness?
It goes back to your definition of mystery. It's hidden. Maybe secret sin or secret depravity. It's not known openly yet.
That okay.
The take out of it.
Okay. And there's a clue in here. Let's see. Let me go back. Let's see. The day will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed. The son of perdition who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or is worshipped. And remember when I was with you, I told you, and I was restraining, that he may be, again, revealed in his own time. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. So this man of sin, he's going to be revealed. He's not revealed yet, but it's already in play. It's already in motion. This mystery is in progress, but it's not fully revealed yet. So just how you see mystery and revelation being connected in a lot of other passages that we just flew through in the last slide, I think they're probably connected in this passage as well. That somehow there's some sin, some plot of sin, as you said, some secret sin or some scheme, something that's underway, but it's not revealed yet. But it's in play already. So just a few verses to think about. Remember what Paul, when he met with the, we talked about this last time, about the Ephesian elders, I think it was Miletus, where he said, after I leave, some of you are going to rise up and try to draw people away. Already at that time, he's telling them there's going to be a falling away, at least coming from your own ranks. That's going to be trying to pull people away. 2 Timothy 3, 2 Timothy 4, 1 Timothy 4, all these passages talk about false teachers pulling people away and how evil men are going to grow worse and worse and in describing similar things. Jude also talks about that in the first 13 verses. So it seems that there was already a kind of an apostasy already afoot. And now whether it was the same one, whether it was the beginnings of it, I don't know. But he did say that it was already at work. So if it's the same one, I don't know.
Why would he speak of another one? I mean, to me, it fits to flow from verse 3 down to here. That he set the stage and said, this is going to happen. And now he's coming a few verses later and said, it's already at work.
Right. Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say.
So, clearly. To me, it's there's nothing that would indicate that he's talking about something else other than what he was speaking of originally. Right.
Absolutely. I think by the context, it's the same thing. All right, so this
kind of ruins the old common Antichrist kind of, you know, it's something yet to come.
Okay, so let's touch on that just a little bit. This is I didn't want to get into what the man of sin was too much. But
oh, come on, we all want to come on.
Debbie, go ahead. What were you going to say?
During this time period, was this the time when the Catholicism was beginning to...
You would have had, like, just the very earliest things. But, I mean, and there's some of the people... All right, let me hang on to that all. All right. So I'm not going to get into a ton of details, but I don't think I'd be doing fair to the class, at least not touch on it a little bit. So what's kind of the main lessons I think we can get out of this prophecy, even if we don't understand the exact specific application? I think one of the things we can get is things are going to oftentimes get worse before they get better. Sometimes apostasy happens, and things do get worse, but God's in control.
There's going to be a judgment. There's going to be a day when that's going to be set right. And eventually, I think very clearly, at the end of this, Jesus, after everything's said and done, he's going to take care of us. He's going to deal with the last of the apostasies and the last of the Antichrist and whatever else he may have. So, now specifically, some of the applications, some of the more common ones that most people throw around is Catholicism. Specifically the Pope, meaning the man of sin. Not any one specific pope, actually the chain of the popes, the papacy itself. Some have also suggested, very similar to Revelation, about Roman, the government, and then emperor worship being the second beast in Revelation. Another possibility is that it's not a specific man or a specific group of men, but really it's just kind of apostasy generalized. In other words, all men of sin, all apostasy in general is going to eventually climax, and Jesus is going to take care of that when he gets back. So, the people that argue for the papacy, getting back to Debbie's question, they list a lot of different points where they already see some similarities. Think about 1 Timothy 4, where he talks about how evil men are made worse, giving a hint to the seducing doctrines of demons, forbidding people to marry, the priests, right? And then also forbidding people to eat meat. So you have to eat fish on Friday and Lent and all those kinds of things. So, you know, was that a beginning of that kind of thing? Demetrius, I think it was Demetrius, who wanted to have preeminence. Again, the idea of him kind of, you know, hoarding up, putting himself in a position that he didn't deserve. And so some idea that there's some kind of hierarchy that's not biblical already starting. So, but, you know, it would be just the very basic stuff. I think church history would show it would be like a couple hundred years before you'd really...
It's actually the next century.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it was the second century. Polycarp, Arrhenius, those men start when their writings of the church fathers, they started already pushing this idea of a preeminent elder, a bishop. And you can see the evolution in those early writings in the early second century. Okay. It may not have been widespread yet.
Right.
Okay. It did take several hundred years for it to get to the point where, you know, that each right. church had its bishop. But it already had its seeds in the early second century.
So, what century was Tertullian? Was he second?
I believe.
One of the things I remember about him is he said, look, dealing with all this false doctrine and all this, it just gives you a stomachache and a headache. Let's just say that all the elders who were at the churches, the apostles established, are the final say. And we're done. And so that was how he said, we need to start settling everything. Is whoever's the bishops of these churches, apostolic succession, whoever set up in those places, they decide. And so again, that's kind of the beginning of that hierarchy. And as Eric said, so, you know, second century, you're already seeing some of that stuff really starting to get into place. But, you know, Catholicism's evolving. I mean, some of the doctrines, you know, they've adopted even the last century, so they're kind of unique to them. So it was an ongoing thing.
Think about it. Look at verses 9 and 10 as well. According to the working of Satan with all power, signs, lying wonders, you think about even something as simple as what, you know, what are the qualifications for somebody to be declared a saint? And they had to have sure. some kind of miracle and of course, all of the relics and various things, and
right.
and all of that kind
the
of
statues that were crying blood. And
right, right. I mean, there's been a lot of things that would sort of fit into
yes.
you know some of these signs and lying wonders and all that kind of stuff that would go along with that. And you know, verse 10, they did not receive the love of the truth. I think clearly there are you know departures from doctrine that have been in the interest of that religious body as opposed to in the interest of Christ and His name. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think the papacy fits it extremely well. I mean, if you look at history and you compare it, wow, it just really lines up well. And the only reason I'm not just head over heels for that idea is because if you think about Catholicism now, and you guys may disagree with me, I just don't think it has the stronghold that it had, you know, say 500 years ago. If you look at people that were, rising up before kind of really the Catholic Church got started, they all thought this passage
was people in their time, and they were trying to pick out specifically, oh, it's this guy that he's talking about. By the time you get to the Catholic Church, they're saying, no, it's the Antichrist. It's the end of time. That's what, when it's going to happen. Nothing to worry about till then. And then by the time you get to the Reformation movement, the Restoration movement, all those guys says, no, it is the Catholic Church. And so that became their target for identifying Revelation as well. And that's something that many of us might disagree with, is we see the climax in Revelation being the Roman Empire. If you go back 100 years or more, most everybody would say it's the Catholic Church. Most of the Protestant groups would say the Catholic Church is what's being talked about, brought down in Revelation. So what happens is when you start to see that shift, you know, in the past few hundred years, people are kind of backing away and saying, well, maybe it's not the Catholic Church. For different reasons. Some people just don't like to pick on the Catholic Church. Myself, I kind of wonder, because it doesn't seem to have the stranglehold that it used to have. But outside of that, it fits really well. The other thing that I think I kind of struggle with a little bit is he talks about the thing that's restraining. And most of the people that are advocates of the idea of it being the Catholic Church say, well, that had to be the Roman Empire. And but my understanding from Revelation is actually it's the Roman Empire that's being brought down. So it seems like that's kind of a conflict of sorts there. But one of the points that most everybody says, I think is a good point, is that at the end of this in verse 8, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. Most everybody says, okay, this has something to do with the gospel or with truth. And that makes sense given the verses that are going to follow this. And the idea that some have suggested is that consuming has to do with some kind of initial blow, but happening, being brought out over time. So you would expect, if that's the case, whatever this is, you would expect to see it withering. So if it is the Catholic Church and you see it slowly dying, that would kind of make sense until it's finally knocked off in the final return, in the final revelation. I don't know. So that seems to be pretty common. I tend to lean toward maybe the Catholic Church being kind of the first, but this being something that's going to continue. I mean, I look at the major problems that we have today. I'm more fearful of Islam, atheism, agnosticism. I mean, I'm more concerned about that than I see Catholic Church being a threat. So, I don't know. Those are the reasons why I have trouble just not loving that interpretation of it. But again, I think that's, I don't want to dwell on that too much, because I think the main points are very clear that we talked about earlier. And I will mention that everybody will say this is the hardest interpretation, because there's a lot of things you have to go look at. You have to go look at Daniel 7, Daniel 11, you have to look at Revelations. You got to have all those right. If you have all those right, then you can understand this. That's a big if. And there's a lot of disagreement there. So, anyway, so you just find tons of variety in things to talk about in the commentators. Alright. Let's see. So let's look at the next section a little bit. Alright, the coming of the lawless one. And if we don't finish this, we'll pick up right here next time. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders. Again, that fits very well with the practices we've seen with the Catholic Church. And with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this reason, God will send them strong delusion, that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. And to me, that is just an amazing verse. And I remember as a child, this having a huge impact on me. The idea that God would send somebody a lie, that just seems kind of out of characteristic with everything I've known up to that point. And very frightening, because it's very clear that he's going to do that for this certain group of people. All right. So I think we've talked about this one. What's the coming of the lawless one like? He's likened to Satan with lying wonders, and powers and signs. You think about Pharaoh's magicians, how they hardened his heart back in Exodus 7 with lying wonders and signs. Simon the sorcerer having his effect on the Samaritans. And then Jesus, I think, talking about leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem, about how there would be false Christs and false prophets who would use deceiving signs and wonders as if almost to deceive even the elect. So this is a pretty common terminology and technique that you see in a lot of different places. Alright, so this lawless one, who's he going to persuade and why will he have success? And I think we've kind of already answered this question that kind of gives it away. How does one have and exhibit a love of truth? So I ask both of those at once. What do you think?
Have a love for the truth, you're going to live by it.
Mm-hmm.
It's apparent that these people accepted the truth. They didn't care to stick to it.
Okay.
It seems to be the difference.
So the people in the apostasy, right?
If you love me, you'll keep my commandments.
All right, very good. What else? All right, so just picking out the text, what it says, that he will be deceptive and he'll have success among those who perish. Why? Because they did not receive the love of the truth. So that's your main reason. And that didn't happen, because otherwise they would have been saved. So they might have been saved. And for this reason, because they didn't receive the love of the truth, for this reason, God will send them a strong delusion. To what end? So that they should believe the lie. Why? That they may be condemned who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. So that seems to be, if you put these together, that seems to be the part. That here are some people, whether we're talking about the apostasy or you talk about people originally receiving the gospel, they're in a state of decision. They have sins, they have sins they like, and they have sins they want to hang on to. Here comes the truth, a system of truth that if they cling to that, they can get rid of their unrighteousness, they can get rid of their sins, but they really want it. So they reject the truth. And because they don't believe the truth, God allows some way, some strong illusion, something else that they can latch on to instead. So, and because of that, they will perish. And the deciding point, though, which sets everything in motion, is the fact that they loved unrighteousness and they didn't believe the truth. And because of that rejection, that sets them up for this condemnation. And the way they're condemned is by God allowing or enabling this lie to be set forth, this strong delusion. And they grab onto it and are lost. So, there's a lot of verses actually that have this same kind of idea. Parallel verses, John 3:19-21. And this is the condemnation, that the light has come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. For everyone practicing evil hates the light, and does not come to the light, lest his deeds should be exposed. But he who does the truth comes to the light, that his deeds may be clearly seen that they have been done in God. So again, this prejudicial deciding of whether or not to confront the truth based on what I want to do. Alright, we'll pick up with this next time. I look forward to your comments and appreciate the comments and questions.
Great, great.